It's Thursday, August 3rd. You're listening to the Tech Breakfast Podcast, the show that brings you delicious tech news and all the hot takes you can handle. It is episode 291, nine away from the big 300. It's just Tyler and I today, although I think maybe we'll try and just give some of Bewley's takes for him. Maybe we can try and answer some of them, you know, on his behalf, since he's not here to defend himself. I think that would be a lot of fun. Yeah. How's it going, Tyler?
No better way to offend someone than pretend to stream their conscience.
What
I'm doing great.
We here to do, you know.
That's fair. That's totally fair. I wonder. It makes me wonder if I haven't seen as much Twitter activity today, but Bewley's out and about live streaming cool stuff with a potato for a camera and an audio device. There, I said it.
Potato for a camera and an audio device. Get wrecked,
oh wait, not Bluey. A potato, an apple.
Sorry, not Bluey. Bluey's a Bluey? I get it, because you went like literally Bluey? With the food. You went from potato to apple. That would have flown right over Bewley's head. Bluey.
He's so mad. It's funny though, because he live streamed something that was really cool. He is at I believe still. I actually don't know the dates. You know, because it's CrossFit, but he is at a CrossFit championship of sorts, maybe world championship, could be local, could be, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend like I know that much about it. All I know is that he's there, I believe, in a coach capacity, which is freaking cool, for Jason Grubb, who is a human machine. And he live streamed Jason absolutely killing some part of the event, where they did lots of crazy muscle bro stuff. And I immediately gave Aaron crap for not having like a gimbal to steady his phone camera, and that was obvious. And it sounded like he was recording through someone else's phone somewhere else nearby. And that's because he was recording on his phone, which wasn't a mic up near his face. And that is only hilarious to Aaron, myself, and probably Russ, because I record all of these podcasts on the equivalent of a potato compared to both of their setups, which some of you probably recognize the quality of the audio from my particular stream. We both got a good laugh out of that. And I actually gave a shout out. I don't think he listens to the podcast, but if he does, maybe this will start it. John McCallop, who was one of my brother's roommates in college, actually does like professional audio at sporting events, like goes to the Olympics on a regular basis to record for various, you know, things. I don't know if it's always TV or if it's different radio programs or whatever, but
right.
Obviously as a total pro in this space, his audio recordings are mind-blowingly crisp and wonderful and amazing. And I figured he actually had some, might have some really good tips for somebody that's trying to do that on like a cell phone sort of setup. Cause I know that they've got all kinds of stuff for that. I don't think gimbals have come down a lot, like a little handheld gimbal to stabilize cell phones and things and then get up and over. Cause he was having to like weave around a lot of people. Anyways, it's kind of cool. It created a funny tech conversation and I figured he could actually up that game without going crazy on the dollars front. And it would be good for Mr. Grubb, who I believe is absolutely leaning on Aaron for social engagement.
Yeah,
but which it was awesome.
Probably a good person to lean on. That's for
heck
sure.
Yeah.
So
it's because Aaron's passionate about literally everything, and in particular, technology, social engagement, and muscle bro stuff. So kind of killing it for Jason.
I think those three areas definitely would define Bewley quite well. In fact, as we maybe try and answer some of his hot takes for him, we'll keep that in mind as we go through this. But we are going to move on to today in tech history only because there's just two of us. We thought we would do it a little bit different today, in which case both of us have looked up our own today in tech history, and we're going to ask the other person. We could end up with the same one. We don't know, but we can tell you that.
Might already have each other's answers. Might be wrong answers.
I mean, we could still get it wrong, you know? So that's I'll tell you what, Tyler. How about you go first, and then I will follow up on you, because I will tell you that I have some very confusing answers and questions.
Yeah. Okay, fair. I'm gonna go with the strangest one that fell into the answer to my questions, which is when did the U.S. nuclear submarine USS Nautilus successfully complete its historic undersea journey, becoming the first vessel to cross the North Pole beneath the Arctic ice cap?
Oh, my.
Yeah, I was really surprised that one even came out in this list, but I dug it, and there you go. Okay. Also, I'm pretty sure we haven't had this one before, but it totally falls into tech, I think.
We have not, and you know, I think we're going to get a little bit more diversity in some of these because we were using kind of a single source method before, right. And we've diversified that a bit. I think AI helps
For sure.
And
thanks, AI. It's
coming up with, I mean, I don't have this one. It's kind of like the second or third week in a row that I've actually put the question into AI just to see what would happen. Doesn't come back with the same thing. So it's fascinating. I'm going to go with 1972.
Ooh, I like it. I'm going to go with 1958, but that's because I have the answer in front of me.
Yes, because you have it right in front of you.
Which, I mean, let's be fair. You were actually really close. So what is that, 14 years? That's not bad for something. So, I mean, I'd say that's pretty out of most people's general knowledge. Like, when were nuclear submarines making historic trips in weird places?
Yeah, you know,
there's a lot of hoops there.
It's you always look at the variables and you try and figure out how do you land in the realm of like the highest probability of those variables. So this was my thought process. If anyone wants to know how my brain works, the moment that question was asked, I said, okay, first nuke dropped in 1945. The Hunt for the Red October came out in 1985 or something. So it's got to be somewhere between there in my mind, you know? And so I just thought to myself, it's probably going to be closer to the Red October than it would be to the first one. But I was wrong in that assumption. It was definitely closer to the first drop. So,
we got him into the submarines fast, apparently. It makes sense, though. You're harnessing that in one case just to create a chain reaction, blow stuff up, and the other one because it's near limitless, you know, source for electricity, which is fascinating in and of itself. But of course, we've got the budget for, you know, submarines in a military capacity before like anything else.
Let's see. I'll move on. So I didn't have that one. I will tell you the first run at this. All I said was today in tech history. That's all I said. And I got a response back and it said, today, August 3rd in tech history, there are no significant events or milestones found in the search results.
It's pretty bad.
I said, try again. That was my follow-on response. And it came back and it gave me two, neither of which were yours. But I thought this was kind of a good one. So, August 3rd on this year, Tandy Corporation and Radio Shack released the TRS-80, one of the first personal computers available to consumers. The TRS-80 exceeded sales expectations and played a crucial role in the early days of personal computing. What year did that come out?
Jeez, I don't, like 70?
1970? Yeah. I mean, you're pretty close. 77. The year of Star Wars.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
It's another
one of those things where you're like, okay. I mean, Radio Shack sells like calculators, you know, like what are we talking about here? But it's a fascinating thing because I know the TRS-80. I mean, this is like, I've actually seen.
That's cool. See, I'm not familiar with that one. And that certainly didn't help. But I was trying to, because I hadn't seen it and I wasn't familiar with it, I was thinking like, all right, when did I start to see personal computers? And that would have been like early 80s, mostly because I wasn't born before the early 80s. And then I just tried to go back far enough where like the first personal computer to really enter the market might have been. And I guess I was just grossly wrong about how fast it went from something like that, which maybe gets that first token, to like an Apple or an Apple II, right? So
the article that it links to as its source has a great image of it. I'll throw it into the chat. Nice. But that looks exactly like the one that I saw. I'm talking like, it may be the same one.
That's just awesome. Sort
of a fascinating look. I mean, that thing right there. Look, you could kill someone with that thing.
That's for sure. It's a
bludgeon. That is a monster. But you know, very cool at the time. That's for sure. All right.
Oh wow.
So I want to move on to news.
And shockingly similar in aesthetic to stuff like the original Apple computers and whatnot.
It really is. I mean, even if you just think of like a computer in general, I mean, obviously,
yeah.
The age, there's a distinct age difference here, but
sure.
It really is a shell of what we use today.
Oh gosh, yeah. Especially because of the CRT monitor and the external floppy drive and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I mean, you can look at this picture and be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's the display. The box under it probably has most of what is the brain. You've got a, you know, you've got a keyboard with a numpad, because is it a keyboard without a numpad? The answer is no.
Ooh. Oh, wow. Hot take alert. We need a soundboard for that one. I'm sitting here without a numpad on my keyboard, and it's starting to weep.
It should weep. That's sad. That's sad for you. It's sad for it. It's sad for everything. I'll say this about the tech history stuff. So I gave a much more descriptive question, but I kicked it into two large language models. I used Bard and GPT, and I think I just left it with the default, which was 3.5. And Bard actually gave me a litany of results, some of which I am pretty sure we've had before. And GPT only gave me 5, but one of those was the submarine one, and it must have been because I asked what are some of the notable historical discoveries, right? So I used that language, and then I said tech and science, so it must have reached out, but it only listed 5, which was interesting, and then what it kicked back was much less of like a bullet point like Bard kind of gave me, which was Graham Bell making a first successful telephone call to his assistant, Sputnik 1 being launched, the Apple II release, none of which I would actually know from memory if that happened on August 3rd, by the way. Like, looking at Bard and thinking, are you wrong?
Even though we've gone through like all of those.
I know.
Yeah, you know who would know? Kieran Sheldon would
probably
know. He'd be like, y'all did it on this episode at this time. This was the answer. But we
facts,
wouldn't, you know.
Facts.
We just wouldn't. So I want to move to the news, and before I move to what I feel like is the thing that you and I both want to talk about the most, I want to follow up on one from, if it wasn't our last one, it was the previous one, but we talked about the degrading accuracy of ChatGPT.
Yeah. I've been watching that a lot. I've been watching it, and I've been watching some of the articles posted, and I'll let you, you know, speak to it, because I think I know which one you're citing specifically. But I actually haven't been using them enough for that kind of stuff to have seen degradation in response. I think the way that I've been utilizing most of these chat models is way more I guess prose-based would be the way to say it, but it's kind of like taking an input and adjusting it, and then maybe adjusting it for a different style because it's fun and it's goofy. And then I have used it for like data mining, where I've attempted to use it for data mining, I should say. And the results for that kind of stuff, especially with GPT, which is not, you know, internet connected, those were such a mixed bag of garbage to begin with that it actually was just a waste of time to try to use them that way. I need to go back, because with Bard being available, I'm kind of curious if things like AutoGPT are able to point to Bard, for instance. I'm honestly not sure if they are, or if just some of the updates that have happened both on the AutoGPT side and on GPT's back end, if they've gotten better, worse, mixed bag. Like, I need to go play with it, but I haven't. But anyways, what'd you find?
First off, we do have a surprise appearance by a Mr. Aaron Bluey.
What is up?
He is here.
What's
live from me? I don't know where you're live from, actually. Where are you from? Where
Pick,
are you
make from? Make flexing noises.
In the...
What? Please don't.
Tyler's just trying to make a fitness term work in the sentence. I don't know. Flexing noises. First of all, nobody in sport just like flexes, but whatever.
No, they do it when they're pushing lawnmower-sized things covered in weights that are okay, like moons.
Okay, fair point. But it's not like a bodybuilding, like you walk on the stage.
No, it is not.
Don't diss Arnold, man.
I was going to say, oh, careful know, now.
For real. Dude, so I saw there's didn't he have like a new documentary out? It's like the three different lives of Arnold or something like that.
He does. I've heard it's really good. I haven't watched it yet.
Mm. Yeah, I'd like to catch it. No, I'm coming to you live from the CrossFit Games here in Madison, Wisconsin.
There you go. And you are in a coaching capacity, as we tried to explain earlier. Okay, we got that right. Well, Tyler got it right.
That's absolutely correct. So I'm currently just
I gave you mad props for almost everything you're doing out there. You'll have to listen to the beginning of the episode.
helping my friend go win his fourth gold medal, that's all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, man. No, I just wanted to jump on and listen to y'all live. We're going to line up and head he's heading in for his final event in about 30 minutes. So I had a few minutes of downtime, but I'll jump in and listen to you guys talk about Bard or whatever it was when I jumped in.
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're actually revisiting a topic from the previous pod where we talked about the declining nature of the accuracy of GPT, in particular around math. It dropped from like 98% to 2% based off of a study. So that's kind of where we are. And so the reason why I bring it up is I don't know if this is the reason, but I was actually posed a question by a listener, shout out JJ, who basically just inquired. He's like, why do you think ChatGPT is getting less accurate? And I couldn't have answered that question unless he had texted me at the time he did or any moment after that, because I literally was in the middle of reading an article by The Economist on the scaling challenges, really more financially, like the efficiency of training and running these models, that they, in the ways people were going about trying to make it more efficient. And there was two key things that were interesting. One was just the staggering amount of operational costs ongoing it takes to run these models. It is absolutely wild. And so there's two methods that they can go through to try and, as they stand today, to make them more efficient relatively easily. And that is, you train with less parameters, but more data, whereas GPT was primarily trained on a lot of parameters and a relatively small amount of data. It was still a lot of data, but not as much as you might think. And so this was a use less parameters and more data, because that makes the computational aspect of it cost less. And the other one, which was extremely germane to the topic at hand, was on rounding numbers off to shorter decimal places. So each decimal place you kind of came down, it actually would exponentially decrease the computational requirements of doing the work. And I'm wondering if is the reason why a lot of this is changed over the time. I don't know, and the article wasn't about it. But I was asked at that time, and I thought that was a fascinating thing.
That wouldn't surprise me. I remember seeing the article, and I think it's what we referenced last time we were chatting, that talked about the massive delta between initial versions of GPT and recent, where it was 98% right initially, 2% right at this point, right? Or right that often, I believe what it was. But if you're shedding decimal places and you're doing something like an Euler function or anything like that, where you're using linear algebra to approximate answers and find it in basically an area of potential possibility, and then you're optimizing it, shedding the decimals off the backside of that could dramatically change where you're going to land. And I hadn't really thought about that before. I think a lot of people, rightfully so, I did when I saw the article without really reading it. You look at that and you think, well, math should have a pretty static answer to a question. So it's disappointing that something like this is spitting out, effectively garbage 98% of the time now. But we're talking about the kinds of math that need all those decimal places to get more and more accurate. So it kind of makes me want to go back and read it and really understand what it was that they were using GPT to answer. But given what you just said, I would put money on it being that kind of approximations, where the sensitivity to those trailing decimal places is probably pretty high in some cases, if not lots of cases, which is, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I even, you know, I was thinking as I was looking at that and some of the numbers they gave, I'll put the Economist article in the chat, but the to operate ChatGPT was wild. It was like $6 billion, either a like a year or something at this scale. And then so that's why they were having to like really work on scaling it back. I mean, that uses up that Microsoft funding really quick.
Yeah, it does. Wasn't that a $10 billion investment?
Like, $10 billion. So if that you number got
a
is
year
right,
and a half a run rate,
it's and just that doesn't wild. Include
people.
and a lot of that, you know, ultimately could be, you know, maybe they just didn't expect the explosion of use, right?
Could
that
be,
that
sure.
came with it. But nonetheless, it's fascinating to look into and to think about. I personally have used it on the math side really for things that I'm able to, you know, I'm looking to understand basically probabilistic things or things that are less exact. Like I'm defining the variables for like formulaic stuff inside of Excel for whatever it might be. You saw some of the performance stuff I made in an Excel doc. And I used it to help with some of that stuff. But I was able to sort of define that error pattern. I can tweak and I can pull those levers. And it's just something that, you know, I don't have to worry too much about. But whenever you're really trying to measure the efficacy growth of something, math is, like you said, it's a really good barometer to use because in many respects, we know what the exact outcome should be, you know,
in a lot
if
of
you
cases,
go to try and do that. Yeah, in a lot of cases, obviously, very much so. And much to my dismay early in my math scholastic career was very, very frustrating. I hate proofs, by the way. I just hate them.
I'm not a big fan myself.
Just is what it is. But anyway, so I thought that was fun. And I also thought that efficiency piece here and the difficulties of managing something at scale played really, really well into the other story, which I can bring up or you can give us a summary of, but I was thinking about the superconduction kind of potential breakthrough that we've seen so far that was announced whatever it was a day or two ago.
Yeah.
You want me to roll into it?
No. I mean, like I've been following this interestingly on Twitter, and we can get into that because it touches on some of the stuff we've been talking about lately. As far as, you know, sources for sort of new dropping data where I would usually say this was Reddit. It was absolutely not Reddit because Reddit killed its third-party apps. It makes me sad. And I use it a lot less as a result. But Twitter has some really cool accounts that are worth following. Maybe I'll drop a couple that I've seen into our thread. But they've really, like the scientific community, the physics community in particular, a lot of material science people are chiming in. Folks that work in this domain have like come alive on Twitter to sort of post their thoughts and do some of these experiments because a Korean research organization, which I believe was specifically calling out in one of these threads that like their backgrounds don't align to the traditional sort of physicist realm that this falls into, but they published a paper with some interesting, you know, social history behind it about their belief that they have discovered and can prove and have given lots of detail on how to reproduce ambient temperature and pressure superconducting materials, a specific material that they refer to as LK99, which can be produced using widely available materials. I forget. I think it's lead, copper, oxygen. I know is in there. There's something else, phosphorus maybe. Yeah. Anyways, these are all super common materials. And then they actually in their paper published the results. Which a lot of folks on Twitter actually, in this community, folks that work in the superconducting space, because we use superconductors in lots of places, these aren't science fiction, they very much exist. What is groundbreaking and phenomenal is that this discovery is superconducting material that operates at a room temperature, at a standard atmospheric pressure, and that opens up so many possibilities that like the entire scientific community is ablaze. There's anger about the lack of proper peer review before it was published. There's anger about the way that the paper was published and who was putting it, and it goes to the rules of like winning Nobels, where you can only have three people in those kinds of that can simultaneously be awarded and stuff. I saw one thread which just sticks in my head that specifically said the way this paper is outlined and the data that they provide can almost certainly only be two things: the biggest discovery we have seen probably in our lifetimes, right? From a physics scientific materials perspective, i.e. Nobel Prize 100%, or absolute 100% fraud, they did this intentionally, right? Like, there is no in between, because they said to fake the data, you couldn't do it on accident the way that they did it. And so they've either done this, which is amazing, like I have goosebumps, or they have ruined themselves by publishing this paper. Which is crazy.
It is crazy, and I'm gonna try and, you know, Tyler and I have both worked in and have been scholastically trained in physics to some degree, and so I'm going to do my best to like make this make sense as to the magnitude of it, and I'm not the best person to do it, so we're gonna give it a go here, but. It's important to note that the room temperature piece here is the most important aspect. Now, superconducting, for lack of a better way of talking about what these superconductors largely do that's super, super valuable, is they're unbelievably efficient at moving energy, like literally electrical current, because there's no resistance.
So that's the definition of superconductivity, is zero resistance. So a current in a loop, for instance, will stay in that loop indefinitely until it is given a load to run into.
Yeah, until it's physically extracted from whatever it is that is conducting it. And that is that has implication. Think about everything that requires energy in your life, which is everything, being completely transformed. Because right now these do exist, and I'd have to look this up. I should have looked it up, but the superconductors that do exist today, I'm talking commercially available superconductors that do exist today, they're high temperature superconductors, meaning they have to be relatively actively cooled. Well, they have to be actively cooled to get to workable temperatures. And when I say actively cooled, I'm talking 70, 80 degrees Kelvin, like minus 200 degrees Celsius type of stuff.
My favorite opportunity to actually see superconducting magnets in work, because they're often used for magnetic purposes. A superconducting magnet, you can have a coil of copper, you can create magnetic fields very easily when you have current moving, right? It's just one of those cool properties of magnetism and electricity. And so superconducting magnets are used in things like SLAC, the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and CERN, where we're doing large particle collisions, which we've talked about on different shows before. But to get the array of magnets necessary to steer beams of, you know, protons or positrons in the case of CERN, or smaller particles like electrons, positrons in other colliders, you have to have constant, accurate, very, very strong magnetic fields. And and when I say strong magnetic fields, I mean like crazy compared to the stuff that you're working with like ever, really, right? Like
black holes.
And to make them work, they have to pump liquid nitrogen throughout the facility. CERN is miles wide at its diameter. It is a giant circle, right? We're talking about a tremendous amount of electricity. We also use superconducting materials for magnetics in fusion reactions as well, which is great, because something like ambient temperature superconductors may not solve some of the other problems we have with fusion reactions, like melting everything that's close to it. But it does help a lot with getting a net positive reaction out of it, which happened recently. This is a big freaking deal, right? So all of these, and those are like fringe of science. We're talking about particle collisions. Most people aren't going to walk into their house and think, oh, great, let me get a particle accelerator, or fantastic, I can have my own fusion generator built in my backyard. Actually, I am excited about that one, but I probably won't build that one myself. kind of dangerous. Doing it wrong. But like you said a second ago, if this material is just naturally superconductive at room temperature, so sitting in my office, you think about the way that we print circuit boards. They're generally printed with copper or gold in certain situations because gold has better conductive properties than copper, which has better conductive properties than aluminum, which has better conductive properties than steel. And when you say better conductive properties, there are a few things that go into it. I honestly don't remember all of them, but one of the biggest ones is just internal resistivity. And the easiest way to think about that is if you took a battery and you attach it to a wire, a copper wire, a toothpick, or not a toothpick, a paperclip, you know, unbound. Yep. What happens when you bridge that gap? They get hot. A superconductor won't get hot. It has no resistance. There is no loss to heat, which is how it keeps the circuit moving. Everything could move, you know, electricity, you know, forever, quote unquote, except that it gets really hot and most of them fail because of that, or, you know, like melt, they fail in different ways, but they melt other things that are associated with them. So almost any electric device you have ever been near would benefit from a material like this, so long as it can be printed onto a circuit board or spun into wires. I mean, you could literally make a wire out of bricks or something like that, right? Probably not super efficient, but you're power distribution grid, the charges you see on your electricity bill every day for maintaining the lines, some of the long-term damage is done to like attenuation over long periods of time, losses associated over distance, and the losses that are just naturally in the wires that are carried from A to B, those go to zero or near zero, depending on like amplification. I imagine there's still some attenuation that happens, but it's not going to be to resistance, which is you have no loss. We lose tremendous amount of electricity to stuff like that.
Oh, so my gosh.
These are like
an unbelievable amount.
Impactful sort of things that I think a lot of people don't understand or maybe wouldn't immediately imagine would be capable. So this really is fundamentally groundbreakingly awesome if it's replicable.
If this is peer reviewed and confirmed, it will be one of the biggest moments in human history, period.
And we're alive for it.
Yeah.
It'll be really cool to see what comes from it, right? Like, if this is absolutely confirmed, we'll find out where it can be used, because, like I said, there it might, for instance, not make a good material for printing on circuit boards. One of the nice things about copper and gold is that you can thin them out pretty well. You know, gold can literally be an atom's thickness, and that's pretty brilliant for some stuff, and it can still carry current. So that's cool. But there's just a litany of really, really neat applications for superconducting materials in general. Groundbreakingly amazing versions of that for anything that operates at ambient temperatures and ambient pressure. So
And a lot of correlations to other things, and I'll list a few that came to mind whenever I was trying to explain this to my brother, and he just had a kid, so I can see why he didn't care. Congrats, Nick. So my ninth nephew has now, or eighth. Yeah, I have two of them. There's 10 total, so eighth nephew. There's a lot of them. But interestingly enough, if anyone, it's always fascinating to me how these discoveries happen, because so much in science happens by accident, and this largely did too. But imagine for a moment that this was first discovered, or more, maybe even more properly determined, like observed in 1911, which is insane to me. Yeah, I looked this one up. I wanted to be accurate. Interesting. It's really hard to pronounce this name. I'm going to give it a shot. It's Heike Kemmerling Ohms. I'm just going to go with that. And you can look it up if you want to, you know, hound me for getting it wrong. Basically, they found that mercury, and get this, at a temperature of 4.2 Kelvin, minus 269 degrees Celsius, or minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit.
So that's a single
electricity
digit
without resistance.
That's a single digit temperature reading on a scale where zero means atoms stop functioning as atoms.
Like that's the real zero.
Electrons don't move.
So I thought that was fascinating, because really, the areas where this has kind of been, I guess you could say, more recent for me to have any real interest in is actually around quantum computing. Not just because of like the physical power requirements of quantum computing, but because qubits are by design superconducting. Like that's the intent of like how the qubits function. So they're very, they're into your point earlier about how much can we shrink this down? You know, qubits are tiny superconducting circuits. That's literally what they are. And so building these tiny systems that can be cooled effectively and ran, you know, efficiently for a low cost has just been a complete non sequitur. I mean, it just, it's
kind of a nightmare.
Yeah, it's an absolute nightmare, not to mention that it could explode. And you're trying to like, you know, you're trying to work on these really, really complex problems of non-traditional physics, right? And And you're doing it at the same time as working with something that in concept is understood, in practice is so far away from being fully understood, right?
Right.
It's really cool because superconducting qubits are things that can be entangled. And having that energy to have what we call quantum entanglement is an absolute requirement. You have coherence time that superconductors maintain with zero resistance in order for you to conduct these tests. So there's just a lot of different things that you can do with this. Like one of the major issues we have is the high number of errors that you have inside of quantum computing. That's what the coherence time is there to measure. And the longer coherence time that you can achieve, the fewer errors and more reliable the actual computations are. So we can actually start to do something. Whereas right now we're sitting at, you know, from a computational timeline perspective, quantum computing is like sitting in the vacuum tube timeline. This might get us to that TRS-80, you know, that we talked about earlier.
TRS-80 quantum. There you go. TRS-80Q. Yeah.
We just need Radio Shack to come back.
Come on,
we're
going to
be good. I know Elon's going to be all over this because it's going to have huge things for, you know, space exploration, electric vehicles. I mean, homes.
I'm curious. I wish we should get somebody on the show that maybe can answer this question. But as you were talking about quantum computers and things like that, you mentioned one of the risks is that they could blow up because, you know, you're cooling something that would naturally get very, very hot without it. And lots of downstream problems with that. But the same thing actually happens with traditional transistor-based processors in a in your laptop. If you don't have adequate cooling, that they'll pop, they'll explode in some cases. There are actually some great videos out there that are totally worth going and watching where people do this on purpose. But I'm curious, because we do have superconducting materials, I guarantee someone has tried this. What happens with a modern processor if you make it out of superconducting material? Do we actually have a fab that can do it? Is it worth it?
Maybe not.
I don't know. But I would assume somebody tried it. At what point does overclocking not help?
ironically, with our current transistors, we're already kind of there. It's interesting. I have AMD. We have similar processors. You have the 7950, right?
Yeah, I think so.
The 7950 X3D. Now the X3D adds this higher amount of third layer cache, which is super, super sensitive to heat and power, kind of like a superconducting circuit is. And so with that, it's basically limited on what it can boost and overclock to. And most of the performance gains, ironically, come from trying to lower the power,
the temperature
that you give to it, so that it does it, so it can hold its boost longer because the temperature spikes.
But this is exactly what I was thinking about, is that if you had a superconducting material in there, temperature, because I'm assuming most of what makes a processor hot is the resistance of all of its internal circuitry. I may be wrong in that, but I can't think of anything else that would be doing that off the top of my head. So if it were built on superconductors, it would be cool all the time, which means you could just keep pumping more power into it. Yes?
Think about the way that the power request works. So gigahertz, everyone likes to talk about how many gigatrons do you have in your computer and all that. But what they don't realize is that gigahertz is actually a measure of power. So what it does is the operating system says to, you know, to the kernel, which then talks to the hardware, and it says, we're doing this thing right now, Mr. Kernel. I need this much power to facilitate it. And then the kernel then, you know, translates that to the hardware. The hardware then sends that up to the computer. And so that's why so much of this is controlled at the software layer. So you're literally getting higher and lower power requests. Mm-hmm. And that is what's driving the high amounts of friction you get in and subsequently having it, you know, having it heat up. Because whenever you have high gigahertz running and your fans start spinning up to try and keep it at a very certain temperature, usually, you know, like 80 degrees Celsius or so, which is really hot, by the way. Don't touch that. don't touch that. But not speaking from experience, but it's not fun. if you lose that and you don't have protections in place, it will literally catch on fire and explode. It'll start smoking. And so it's just something that's amazing because there's actually been some issues, even with like my particular processor and main board around controlling some of that with some of those safeguards that had some bugs in them early on. Luckily, I knew enough to be able to sort of control it myself, but I would have been terrified for like an average consumer who should never have to think about that to find out about it. I was lucky enough to not only find out about it, but to know how to handle it, you know, which was a major part of it. But yeah, it's an interesting thing that people don't even really know that everything is sort of a measurement of a power draw request from the operating system, which is how all stuff ends up working. Anything else on the day? I mean, I did see some like kind of flyby headlines that were pretty fascinating. Like OpenAI, speaking of the AI side, admittedly saying that it cannot identify AI-generated text. So
yeah, I saw that because didn't they release something briefly that was supposed to be like an audit function? You could plug in text and it would tell you whether or not an AI made it. Is that what it came off of, or am I just hallucinating this?
You know, other companies, I say companies, other, I'll just say organizations, because I don't know if it's commercial, they've immediately, and I actually wondered about this. I mean, a lot of people were wondering, it's like, what is the validity of these people who say, we can see if you're using AI? Because there were like college students, they got in trouble over it. There was one person
who didn't
use AI and was adamant about it, but it kept showing that he did use AI, and it became this problem. And so, whoops. I think a large part of this is like OpenAI basically stating like, hey, it's great that you think that you can determine this, but like, we can't.
That's awesome.
So like, what does that say for universities and whoever else who are like doing this? Now, some teachers are crafty and they were like trying to get the students to admit their wrongdoing, of which several of them did.
That's the rub.
Any
good lawyer will tell you just to comply without telling them anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Just less words is better. But this was fascinating to me because I have seen a lot of people like when they're trying to create certain things to be like, well, how do I do this and make it to where it passes like an AI check? And I'm like, what AI check are you going to run into? Like my sister asked me this question. I'm like, you work for our father. Like, what is he checking? You know, your AI stuff for, but this is a concern that people have. And then OpenAI is coming out and saying, well, you know what? Maybe it can't even be done, at least at the moment, which is an interesting thing to do, especially from an anti-cheat video game thing where they're trying to detect AI behaviors. And I hope they figure that part out. Let's see what else that we had on the docket here. Reddit beats the film industry. Since you and I are never on Reddit anymore, it's hard for us to see this.
Apparently, I did not see this.
This is from Ars Technica, and there was something going on where Reddit was, or the film industry was going to have to, or was making Reddit identify users who admitted to torrenting. So if you make a comment on Reddit about torrenting. Yeah.
That's funny because they do have subreddits. I have seen, like, sometimes I'm just looking for, I run a Plex server just for different things to you know, various sources that it will aggregate from. And so sometimes when I'm looking how to migrate it or fix it or do something with Plex, I'll come into these Reddit threads that are like clearly just illegal content discussion. And I'm like, well, that's bold. But it has to be based on that kind of stuff. And every time I see it, I think back to Something Awful. And like, what was it, 2004? Because Something Awful had an entire part of its forum dedicated to content that was just there, you know.
Yeah.
Carte blanche, take what you want. Right. And it got shut down. I put shut down in big old bunny quotes. I think they just got pressured from like the MPAA, RIAA at the time. I'm not sure there was ever like a legal proceeding for it or anything like that. So this is actually kind of fascinating too. How did Reddit beat them? What was the...
Well, there's two things here. poor film industry. One was... According to the U.S. magistrate judge, in her ruling, said the issue is whether that discovery is permissible despite the user's right to speak anonymously under the First Amendment. So that's going to be a difficult hill to climb over for film. But what's even more interesting, and I had no idea about, I don't know anything about statute of limitations, but Reddit in their filing to sort of get this thing going is like, I guess a countersuit was, they pointed out that the statute of limitations for copyright infringement is 3 years. And the film company said, no, that's not relevant. And
that's,
the judge
that's
was
not
like,
it.
Well, it, yeah, is, it is relevant, actually. So, it was there's some choice verbiage in here from comments of like people on Reddit that are commenting about this particular circumstance that I'm not going to repeat.
That's too funny.
Cuz it's a family friendly show. But anyways, I thought that was fascinating. You know, Reddit needed a win. They really did.
Yeah.
They needed a win. They've had a
rough go of it the last couple of months.
They really have, and I thought
self-inflicted.
Was...
I can't say I feel sorry for them.
Oh no, that point, I do like, not feel sorry for them at all. Other things, Twitter is now X, and then
I needed to make an immediate correction to the conversation that I said in this episode, which is I referred to it as Twitter. It's not Twitter anymore. It's X.
It's not,
at least it until is. They lose all of their trademark suits.
Yeah, and we talked about that a little bit on the last one. The interesting news here is they put a big giant X logo on their building, which they then subsequently had to remove because they were blinding residents with flashing.
But it was so much more than that,
light.
Too. They got in trouble for removing the Twitter logo because I guess San Francisco has laws about the face of the building. I did not read into it, but I was just like, that's funny, right? Just you didn't get your permit kind of problem. Then they got in trouble for putting up the new one, probably under the same sort of statutes or rules that San Francisco has for their buildings. And then it glued like the sun. Glowed? I don't.
Glued?
What is the word? Glued?
Glowed.
One of those. It has to be glued. Glued does. That's not it.
It's not
so glued.
Glued
like
that's
the
like
sun.
Sticky stuff.
Like all night long. And apparently across the street, at least some of these buildings are, well, whether they're work buildings or living
residential.
Yeah, resident, there's the word. It doesn't really matter. Nobody wants basically a blinding spotlight flashing at them all day and night, which is what it was doing. And so it took like less than a week for that to be shut down and torn down. I'm falling apart here, Russ.
I mean, and it was like a day. And we're final two. We'll fire off real quick. And I'll let you shut it down. One is just germane to our energy piece. The first U.S. nuclear reactor built from scratch in decades
enters
commercial operation in Georgia. Yeah, which is, by the way, for all those people who are like, he said nuclear bad. Wrong. Nuclear good from an energy perspective that we should have never stopped doing that.
Fantastic. I think we actually talked about that in a couple of episodes. Nuclear fuel will continue to be, for probably, well, until fusion, really, the most dense and continuously available source of electricity, continuously, all day, all night, ever, with the least amount of pollutants that we've got. There are other issues around it, but it is phenomenally dense and phenomenally clean relative to other resources that we tend to dig out of the earth and then turn into to heat to make things boil, right? So it's a killer source of electricity that got demonized and honestly set us back a lot. And that's unfortunate because I've said it before and I'll say it again. I think that our demand for fossil fuels, like those that are used to produce gasoline, even coal to some extent, right? It's not going away. We're going to have a lot of things that just need that stuff until Correct. We get to the point where we have locally safe fusion reactions, right? So massive right. amounts of electricity that aren't going to hurt people. So like, stop hating on it. We need it. It's right. great.
Yeah. So it's not even a conversation about nuclear. It's fission versus fusion, people. Like
for sure.
Those are the
for
things sure. that you need to be thinking about. But here's the reality. Once we have nuclear reactors that put energy into superconducting batteries that never run out of energy, yeah. we're going to be good to go. Last thing, and I just think it's funny, Uber CEO gets into an Uber ride in New York, goes 2.9 miles, and
it's like a $50 bill on
price. Yeah, it was a $50 bill, and they asked him how much he thought it was. He's like, I don't know, $20. They're like, no, dude, it's $52. And he goes, what? Like, he just lost it. So I thought,
did he get a smirk at the same time? Because if I'm not mistaken, shortly thereafter, if not within, you know, like weeks of this happening, Uber posted their first financially positive quarter in its history, and they projected they will do so indefinitely going forward. Indefinitely, big old bunny ears. But
what you know what's funny?
That's a big freaking deal.
You know what's funny? He blamed it on inflation. The reporter goes, so it's a reporter who actually was the person who paid the $50. He goes, you know how much my Uber was? $50. And he was like, that's pretty nuts. And he goes, but you know, inflation. So, it's everything's more expensive now. So yeah. it's fine. All right.
Funny how that inflation helped him make a profitable quarter out of everything. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, good for him. He got one. All right. Shut her down and let's get out.
I have a feeling that's going to continue. But man, I don't know if you've used Uber lately, but prices have gone up a lot. It's kind of brutal.
Oh, yeah.
And when it comes to food delivery, it stopped making sense pretty fast in so many cases, in my opinion. But yeah, perhaps another show, because that brings another Tech Breakfast podcast to a close. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We really appreciate you listening in. We have so much fun with this stuff. We're glad you join us. So come again next time, and we'll talk to you soon. Cheers.
Later.